From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Happy birthday, by the way, to 58-year-old Coast to Coast listener Ron in Oregon, and happy Thanksgiving to all our Canadian friends. Good to have you with us. We've got ours coming up in about a month. Three fault segments running beneath Northern California, and it's roughly 15 million people are overdue for a major earthquake, including one section that lies near the dams and canals that supply much of the state's water, according to a geological study. The three fault segments and one other in the region are loaded with enough tension to produce quakes of magnitude 6.8 or greater, according to the study that's published on Monday. Oh boy, just what we need out here. The Ebola epidemic threatens the very survival of societies and could lead to failed states, according to the World Health Organization. They have warned that the outbreak, which has killed some 4,000 people in West Africa, has led to a crisis for international peace and security. They also warned of the cost of panic spreading faster than the virus. Well, there's no doubt about that. In Dallas, for example, about 70 staff members at a Texas Health Presbyterian hospital who were involved in the care of Thomas Eric Duncan after he was hospitalized, including a nurse now being treated for the same Ebola virus that killed the Liberian man who was visiting Dallas as well. The size of the medical team reflects the hospital's intense effort to save Duncan's life, but it also suggests that many other people could have been exposed to the virus during Duncan's time in an isolation unit. And in Kansas City, Kansas, a man in his 40s who complained of a high fever and other serious symptoms contacted and then entered the University of Kansas Hospital at about 6 a.m. on Monday. The hospital says that the patient recently worked as a medical officer on a commercial ship off the west coast of Africa and has a low to moderate risk of Ebola. Gary Ridenour, of course, author of Pandemic, checking in with Gary now on this situation. Gary, first of all, I want to ask you about the fear and the panic. I mean, we got a case in Spain, maybe two, maybe one in Kansas. We've got another one in Dallas. But there seems to be panic all over the planet. What's going on?
Well, in the United States last week, there were 5,000 calls, or, you know, calling wolf, that people that thought that they had Ebola. And since the beginning phases of Ebola looked like the flu and cold and things, everyone thinks that when they get really sick that possibly they've got Ebola. The general public doesn't understand viruses. They don't know what's going on. And so they're really freaking out on this.
Gary, 56 million people died in 2012 from all causes, wars, disease, natural deaths, accidents on this planet. 56 million people. We only had a handful of people that have died around here with Ebola, 4,000 in West Africa. Is it because of the high fatality rate that scares people?
Well, one, high fatality rate. Two, it's far away. We don't know much about it. The one big problem I think and look at is that there are about 20 trillion virus divisions a day in Liberia. And could it mutate? Well, at a rate of 20 trillion divisions a day, the answer is yes.
What about airborne?
Airborne could be a possibility. One of the big things they're missing, though, George, is that ultraviolet light at 254 nanometers kills Ebola. There's a purple laser for a millionth of a billionth of a second that will kill all bacteria and viruses in a room. There are UV robots now. One is called Xenex robot that can go around and clean a hospital. At this point, if I had somebody with Ebola, I'd have ultraviolet lights at that range above the bed, on the sides of the walls, and under the bed, so I'd be killing Ebola all the time.
Gary, shouldn't we just take a get-tough policy and say, one, no planes are coming into the country from West Africa until it is under control and it goes away, and that's just the end of the story. That's the way it's going to be.
We'd hope so. as we talked about before, if we would give the airlines, make them say that you have to buy a ticket and wait 21 days before you leave the infected area, the average Ebola patient goes down in 10. So you'd have a pretty good chance of having clean people coming on board the plane if they waited 21 days to get a ticket.
Are people panicking unnecessarily?
Yeah, I believe so, because it's a virus. They don't know how it's transmitted. Eight, 9 times a day, a patient will ask me, and I lick my finger and touch the desk, and I went, all right, that virus is there for 4 to 6 days. You rub your thumb over it and get a sandwich, and you've got Ebola.
Gary, thanks. I appreciate that. The stock market couldn't shake off a case of the jitters from last week and closed sharply lower again Monday. Airlines, obviously, energy and material stocks were among the biggest decliners. The market is coming off its biggest weekly decline in more than 2 years. As many as 180,000 people have fled fighting between Iraqi forces and Islamic State militants in and around the city of Hit in western Anbar province. The civilians, many of whom were already displaced, have headed east towards the war-torn city of Ramadi. The UN says the refugees are in need of food, blankets, and medical supplies. It's an absolute disaster in Iraq and Syria right now. Let's check in with WND's Jerry Corsi on this one. Jerry, where's the Iraqi army?
I think, George, the Iraqi army largely laid down their arms and fled. As soon as the U.S. military pulled out of Iraq, the Iraqi army disintegrated. And what we've got right now is ISIS is advancing. They're advancing on Kobani in Syria, which is right on the Turkish border, and they're on the outskirts of Baghdad, and the few bombing attacks the United States military is undertaking are not sufficient to really stop the advance of ISIS at this point.
Jerry, with this advance, it appears that the weeks and weeks of bombings hasn't done anything to these militants.
I'd say it's been the impact of the U.S. bombing has been negligible on the advance of ISIS. From the beginning, there was doubt that unless we had boots on the ground, we could really stop ISIS. And I think now the evidence is in. ISIS is advancing. They're not being stopped by U.S. bombing. We have very few bombing attacks going on. And I suspect within the next few days, ISIS will take Kobani, right on the border with Syria, and will begin focusing on moving into Baghdad.
Yeah, they're very close to the Baghdad airport right now, aren't they?
Yes, they are. When Baghdad falls, that'll be effectively the fall of Iraq into the new caliphate that the ISIS, you know, this caliphate state, the Islamic State in a secular way that ISIS believes it can establish across both Syria and Iraq, and I think they're very close to achieving that objective.
And what will they do with all the Christians who are left in those countries?
Well, George, that's one of the great tragedies. The Christians will die. They'll be brutally massacred. There'll be probably tens of thousands of people killed by ISIS, including Islamic believers who are not sufficiently militant or religious enough for the ISIS strict adherence to Sharia law. ISIS is violent to even Islamic believers, and this is the problem. ISIS is a brutal, almost like 14th century massacre of people.
Hey, Jerry, they also found Kim Jong-un, so I've got a story on that. Thanks for everything you do.
Sure, George. Thank you very much.
Jerry Corsi. Yep, Kim Jong-un has reportedly made his first public appearance in more than a month in North Korea. The North Korean leader gave field guidance to a newly built residential district and visited the Natural Energy Institute of the State Academy of Sciences. Look, he hasn't been seen in public since September 3rd. This is still weird. Something's going on there. Whether they've taken power away from him and they're saying, look, you're just a figurehead, I don't know. But it's very, very strange. Listen to this story. The owner of a parrot that spoke English with a British accent says the bird went missing for 4 years, only to return speaking Spanish and asking for someone named Larry. True story. Well, on October 13th, 1775, the Continental Navy was established by the Continental Congress, launching a 239-year naval history across the seas of the world. Now, though the Department of the Navy recognizes this date as the establishment of the U.S. Navy, there is no official designated location as the birthplace of the Navy, since a number of ports played a significant role in the start of the Navy. And in a moment, it's time for Time Tracks. That's right, Project Merlin up next. Paul Guercio joins me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Knorr. You know, for years, we have been talking about the Merlin Project, this incredible futuristic project, and we'll have Paul Guercio explain it to those of you who are new to the program. And it is a predictor of things to come, trends, people's lives, events. As a matter of fact, Paul sent me my time track. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. I think I'm going to flatline in a few years, but I'm not sure. I'll have Paul interpret it. But Paul Guercio, nationally respected futurist, longtime student of traditional and esoteric predictive systems. He has spent years in the sciences and collaborating with Dr. George Hart, who is a Star Wars physicist specializing in the application of supercomputers. And together, they came up with what is called The Merlin Project. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com along with timetracks.org. His clients include a number of business people, politicians, you name it, people who just want a glimpse of the future, but in a different kind of way. Welcome back to Coast, Mr. Paul Guercio. Hey, Paul, welcome.
Thank you, George. I was a little amused because I got a phone call from Tom. And we had the time screwed up tonight, apparently. And George and I were both taking naps, expecting to be on with you in about 2 hours. And Tom says, no, I got my papers screwed up. I had you in the staples in the middle of the... Anyway, here we are. So, listen, I caught the last couple of minutes, and one of the things that's worth mentioning is that you and I and George, Dr. Hart, when we were on together in July, early July this year, you had asked, you know, are we finished with 9/11s? Are we finished with the heavy investment in the Middle East in terms of terrorist activity and so on? And we said to you, well, actually, it's been pretty quiet the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. That's true. We haven't exhibited any serious 9/11 type activity and so on. There may have been things that were interrupted in progress that we don't know about, for instance. But you know, as long as it didn't happen, that's for good for us. But what we said to you was that the time tracks run for 9/11 looked like there was going to be an uptick in terrorist activity over the next probably 2 to 3 years, and they were right around the corner from it beginning, and that was about maybe a month or at most 2 months before we started hearing the word ISIS or ISIL, before there were any beheadings, before there was any consideration to bomb you know, northern Iraq and southern Syria and on and on and on. And it was exactly what we suggested, and nobody was suggesting it at that point, especially because the president has been repeatedly saying, no boots on the ground, no boots on the ground. And listening to Jerry Corsi a few minutes ago, I think when we get George on with us in hopefully a few minutes, he will agree that there's going to have to be boots on the ground.
Yeah, I think so too. If you're going to try to win, you're going to have boots back on the ground. And what a very unpopular decision, Paul. But you know, this is one of those damned if you do and damned if you don't, and we're trapped.
Well, you know, if one of the things about being president, and I think this has been one of George's complaints all the way back to the beginning, because I clearly remember that in leading into 2008. You know, George was very high on Barack Obama and contributed some money. So I knew he was really high on him.
and he has been down on him worse and worse over the last 6 years, to the point where it's hard to carry on a conversation about it without George getting angry. And it has to do mostly with the fact that I guess it's nice to have a law professor as president if you're not in these kind of times. You have to be, you know, you really have to be much more of an aggressive guy, a little bit like, if you look back on presidencies, like Lyndon Johnson even, to be able to not only get legislation through the Congress, but also to, you know, to decide to actively go after something, even if in the case of Vietnam, that was not the right thing to be going after, any more perhaps than Iraq was when George Bush went in. But again, he's talked about between a rock and a hard place. I mean, here we are, we're 20-some-odd days, I believe, 20-some-odd days from the 2014 election, with all of the you know, the effects that could produce if the GOP wins the Senate and so on, with no place to go with some of these things. I mean, they're going to be very unpopular, and the Republicans, I think, are going to have a hell of a hard time finding any place to hide, not giving approval to this, because, you know, what do you do? And by the way, while that's going on, we happen to have a maybe epidemic on our hands.
I know. It's just all coming down at the same time, Paul. And I'm beginning to sense people cracking. They're cracking at the seams.
Well, you may not remember this, but thank God for tape and video at this point. Back before the second Obama term, which we had predicted was going to happen, which flew in the face of most of the pundits anyway at that point. And we did it on your show.
Yes, sir.
That Obama was going to be reelected. We also said repeatedly that about a year to a year and a half into the second term, as George likes to call it, the wheels were going to fall off. And the Obama presidency was going to find itself enmeshed in situations like this, maybe unlike anything previously, back to the FDR administration, maybe back to Lyndon Johnson, in terms of the level of need and the size of the problems. And you know, you look at the Merlin time track for the second Obama administration, you'll actually see this, and you don't need to be a genius to see it on the graph. As a matter of fact, something I should mention right up front here is that you guys thankfully happen to have all of these time tracks still on the website.
Yes.
So if you go to the Coast to Coast website, the homepage, and you look for the little search engine block
up there in the corner.
Right. And you type in time tracks, it'll take you to a page. If you then scroll down that page, you'll come to a set of time tracks all listed. So Hillary Clinton is listed, Kim Jong-un is listed. Okay. And the reason he was on the list at the time was because he's got a birthday that is going through enormous changes at this stage, so that something like a coup or serious illness, or, you know, maybe he's going to contract an infection like his father had in collecting U.S. porn.
Right.
Something very odd was about to go
on. And by the way, time tracks is spelled...
Which is why he was on our list.
T-R-A-K-S, right?
T-I-M-E, T-R-A-K-S. No C, but with an S.
All right, hold on, Paul. We're going to take this break. We're going to come back. Paul Guercio with us. Merlin Project, it's an incredible, incredible just piece of software that literally picks events in a person's life or events on the planet, and it spikes it. And I was able to learn how to read these time tracks. So you don't know if it's going to be good or bad. You don't know that, but you know that something big is about to happen when you look at where the spikes are. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We have Paul Gersio with us from the Merlin Project. Paul, give us a quick overview of Merlin and how this all happened.
I got to tell you about just a joke. You and I are both old enough to remember Breaking Up Is Hard to Do.
I love that song.
The last bumper. Yep. That's Neil Sedaka.
That's right.
One of Neil Sedaka's nieces is a client of mine.
Really?
Yes.
I love it.
The universe has fun
it
ways.
It is a small world.
It sure is. And by the way, I picked up your app about 3 or 4 hours ago, and it's wonderful.
Good.
And now we both have
apps.
That's right. I can tell my clients, not only can you download mine and George's, but you can download George and Ori's and have a field day. That'll be great. I'll have to tell. It's wonderfully laid out. I was very impressed with
it. Oh, the staff knows what they're doing, I'll
tell
you.
Well, they did a great job.
Yeah.
They really did a great job. And did you tell everybody that at least temporarily it's free?
I do that once in a while, yeah. It is free.
Okay, that's
it'll always be free.
Can we count on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Don't make me sign anything, but...
No,
yeah.
I'll try not to do that. Merlin started out basically as an effort on my part to try and computerize what I had been fooling with for, at that point, probably 25 years.
Wow.
I had studied some of these mystical systems, astrology and tarot and Ouija boards and numerology and on and on. Not because I'm a little off. Well, maybe I am.
Maybe you are.
But it was much more a case of a curiosity, because way back in the late 60s, I had put together a link up of college radio stations up and down the East Coast. And I put together a 3-hour radio show called the Truth About Psychic Phenomena. And I had engaged people like Rod Serling and Barry Farber in New York and a bunch of people, including the editor and publisher of what became Analog, the science fiction magazine. And before that, it was Astounding, a fellow named John W. Campbell, Jr. Campbell, there's an award in the science fiction industry named after Campbell. One of his claims to fame was that he had given Isaac Asimov his first paid assignment when Asimov was 17.
That's great.
Okay, and I had Campbell on that show as a guest. I was told he doesn't do shows. And I tried to convince him that he'd be speaking to unsullied minds of college students up and down the East Coast. So he agreed to do it, and we did a wonderful 3-hour show from studios in New York, and the show went swimmingly well, and we did several other ones, and that was in 1967 and 68, and 3 years later, formed in a very similar fashion to what we had initially put together as a model, along came National Public Radio, which was all a string of college radio stations. Mm-hmm. It was the same thing we had done 3 or 4 years before, and so NPR is a spin-off what I was doing back in the late 60s. And as a result of that show, that particular one, I got bitten by this stuff, and I got together with some of the people who had been guests on the show, and over a year or so, and I said, tell me what you know of this. I mean, how much of this is real and how much of it is imaginary? And they spent, thankfully, very, very good, considerable time with me over the next year or so, basically bringing me up to speed on this. And as a result, I spent, God, I must have spent 10 years looking into this as a side profession, basically, looking to see if these mystical systems all had some common thread. In other words, did the Egyptians and the North American Indian Indian and so on, did they all, were they all essentially noticing something and assigning meanings to it that may have been apocryphal, but nevertheless, at a baseline level, there was some level of truth to this stuff. And I concluded that the thing that tied these all together was that they all had some very interesting ways of looking at time, the passage of time, and not in the way that we think of it. So not in hours and minutes and seconds and weeks and months and years, but in much larger increments, like, for instance, the biblical seven lean years and fat years.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from?
Right.
Well, they must have noticed something to have brought that out. And what you find is if you look through those systems, you find that seven-year increment, for instance, popping up everywhere. So what were they doing? What had they noticed that caused them to begin to develop some religion out of this or some crude science out of it? And over the span of 25 years, I came up with a manual way of collating all of that information that they had been using to predict things. And one of my mentors, you can Google this guy, was a fellow named John H. Nelson. Nelson was an employee for probably 30 or 40 years of RCA. And RCA in those years, in the 30s and 40s, the only way they could essentially do, place-to-place communications, because there were no satellites,
right.
there was no under the ocean
cables, nothing.
Right, there was nothing. So what they were using for point-to-point communications in those years was shortwave.
Hmm.
One of those museum pieces today.
That's right.
And what they hired Nelson to do, what his job was referred to as, he was called a radio propagation analyst. He was hired to come up with a way of figuring out when there was going to be sunspots and solar flares sufficient to interrupt point-to-point communications. And over a number of years, Nelson came up with a formula for doing that, such that he could predict that on Tuesday at 3 o'clock, there was going to be a Class A solar flare. So they'd have to use certain frequencies as opposed to other frequencies if they planned on doing any point-to-point communications. What Nelson had also noticed and was part of his formula was that increments of time that are essentially represented by a kind of very baseline astrology, okay, what we might think of in what I like to call applied astronomy, okay,
mm-hmm.
Things like oppositions and squares of the planets and conjunctions of certain planets and so on, had an effect on solar activity so that he could use those angular arrangements, because the universe is mathematical, it's going to happen at the same time so many years later or so many months later or whatever it is. In other words, the outer planets and so on correspond in a larger kind of clock to the ones we actually use for time. So we don't think of the fact that time in our universe here is planetary. It's the Earth's movement on its axis, it's the Earth's movement around the sun, it's the moon's movement around the Earth. Okay, we're talking about, and they have an effect on important things, not only things like communications and births and accidents and so on, but they also have a marked effect on things like tides, which we need.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were, let's say, on the baseline level, if you were a fisherman and you fished for crustaceans, clams and things, you'd want to know when low tide is, because that's when you can go out and actually fish for these things. If you were a shipbuilder, on the other hand, you might want to know when high tide is going to be, so you know when you can launch the ship you've just been building over the last several months. Now, you could also go out and try to clam at high tide or launch ships at low tide, but it wouldn't be advisable, okay? Because you'd have to drag the ship across three quarters of a mile of mud to get to where the water is, or in the case of clamming, you'd have to be pretty good at grabbing them as they go to float away on you. So those kinds of time increments are things we actually pay attention to. But the ones that Nelson was using, nobody pays attention to. Because for one thing, they have to do with stuff like systems like astrology and so on. So Nelson, who was employed by RCA for probably 30 or 40 years, and you, as I said, you can Google him, you can look him up, had come up with a system of using planetary angles not to forecast events, terrestrial events like, something happening to the president or something like that. He was only interested in when these angles would form up, because then he could determine when the solar flare activity or sunspots were going to increase for his employer, so they'd know what frequencies to use to transmit on. Now, if it has that kind of an effect on planetary angles, if those things do have some effect on solar flares and sunspots to the extent that you can make a career out of it, it occurred to me that Nelson was on to the same stuff that I had been running across with all these mystical systems, except he wasn't a mystic and he wasn't an astrologer. He was a serious scientist working for a serious American corporation using this kind of technology to predict things, even if it wasn't the kind of forecasting, for instance, that George and I are doing. It was based on the same theorem. And so when in the late 80s, I was on a radio show in Boston discussing this idea, George was listening. And the curious thing about it was that George had been a regular listener of that show, and I had been a regular guest on it for probably 10 years, and he had never heard me. In fact, I used to guest host that show occasionally, David Brudnoy's show up in Boston. And so he called me up afterwards, and I thought he was just another scientist going to goof on me, because I had run into plenty of that.
Oh, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
When I tried to find somebody who might be able to computerize some of this stuff that I had run across, that's what I would run into by and large. So when he called up and said he was an MIT guy, and he has the invention of this laser that is used in LASIK eye surgery.
The Exmer laser, wasn't it?
That's right. And I believe it was used on you at one point.
It sure was.
Okay, successfully, I suspect.
Yes.
Okay. When I found out who he was, and that this wasn't a goof, he came in to talk to me about what I was doing, and we went through maybe half a dozen iterations of that went on for 6 or 8 hours at a stretch, after which George said to me, you know, I run a division of a company here that's doing SDI research for the Pentagon, and Reagan had just been out of office. It was the end of the second term, and the funding for the SDI program sort of dropped off a little. But not wanting to lose those scientists, the Pentagon continued to fund the program sufficient to keep these guys employed, but not really doing a whole lot.
Just hanging around.
Kind of. And so George said, you know, I got a bunch of SDI guys here with time on their hands and some supercomputers that aren't being used. I think we could spin this up into a program. And that's how this happened.
And did you jump at that opportunity?
You bet.
Smart move.
I had spent the previous 8 or 10 years trying to find somebody who would do that. And I ran into one of two kinds. People who were very enthusiastic, but when it came right down to it, they didn't have the technical skills. And people who had the technical skills who thought I was crazy.
I mean, I was always, when we first started talking years ago on this program, fascinated by it. But then when I started seeing these time tracks, and then we looked at what had happened to people, and then we went back and looked at the spikes, I was sold.
They match up. And what's really interesting, likened to your app that just came out, you know, people say, oh, that's just a show with a bunch of crazies on there. Oh, yeah? Well, now you can load it on your smartphone and find out who's on there. Okay? And in our case, if you load up this app, which for 99 cents, we're not free. For 99 cents, you get a trial period to try it out and see. All you have to do is run it back to your birth year and time and all of that, and then run the graph forward and see whether it matches the years in your life when all the big stuff happens.
The big, in what I said going into the break, we don't know. You can't predict this is going to be a great year because it's spiking like crazy, but you do know something huge is going to happen.
That's right. That's exactly right. And in a sense, it's a little bit like a GPS that tells you where in your lifetime, by years and months and weeks, are things going to spike like that. And if you know when that's going to happen, even if you don't know what it's going to be, and there's a reason why we can't forecast that, but if you know where it's going to be in time, okay, you can then prepare for it. You can either, you know, if you're being the same guy you were 20 some odd years ago when it happened the last time, okay, maybe you better duck because it's gonna come back and it's gonna roll over you. And there seems to be this thing in nature that if you don't learn from the past, you're destined to repeat the past. So if you know when the past is gonna come and haunt you again, maybe you can set some things in motion that would cause the path in the future to be entirely different. So you control a lot of that. And this app, this technology, tells you where to look for that happening and is right probably at least 75, 80% of the time. So in other words, 8 times out of 10, you're going to get the right time coordinates for the next batch of big stuff that's going to happen in your life, and you can start to look around and see who maybe you better get out of your life, like maybe you're in a bad marriage, or you're working for the wrong company, or you're not getting what you deserve, okay? Or maybe you're in some kind of fairly hazardous job, like being a miner or something, and maybe this is the time to start looking for something else to take up your employment time. It's that kind of thing. It gives you an advanced look around the corner to see where in the future the next batch of big stuff is going to happen. And because you can run it backwards with this app, you can determine how accurate that's liable to be based on what you already know.
That's exactly right. Now, by the way, Paul, I want everyone to know Lex has taken your time tracks and has put a simple link at coasttocoastam.com for everybody, because we're going to go through these when we come back. Go ahead.
Lex, bless you. Okay. And Sean, I don't know if Sean's still with you guys.
Joe, Sean's still with us.
Okay.
Sure.
The two of them have been wonderful to me over the years in terms of getting pages up where your listeners can go to and actually see these things so they know we're not kidding anybody. If you go to Kim Jong-un's run right now, and you take a look at what's going on right now, and when it started to get busy, okay, and what was going on in the several years before we ever heard of this guy.
Hold on for a sec, Paul. We're at the top already. We're going to come back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And get up to the website. It just says View Tracks. Click that, because we're going to go through that. I'm going to make a prediction about Hillary Clinton based on the time tracks. We'll be back.